by kind of pushing me away from homeostasis, by making me confront fundamentally different cultures to my own, fundamentally different perspectives to my own, putting me in situations which were at times terrifying, or and certainly made me, and there were times which caused me to reflect very deeply on my own kind of like character failings, were incredibly powerful. And people always think that my path has been strange, from kind of like round the world yacht racing to polar expeditions to kind of to CEO. But in many ways, I feel there's been a very common thread.
That's Tony Hale, and this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. And if you've been here before, you know that this is a show in which I use the lenses of risk, resilience, randomness, and uncertainty to explore all kinds of very interesting topics with fascinating people, with a goal overall of bringing you conversations that you can both enjoy and also get something out of. I've had adventurers, entrepreneurs, athletes, writers, journalists, all kinds of great people, people who are experts in their fields or simply have something wonderful to share. And I want to get into the episode that I have for you this week because it's a great conversation. But before I do that, just a couple of very quick announcements. First of all, just in regards to the schedule for the show, this is how it's going to work going forward. So every other week, there will be a full episode. So it's September the 6th. When this episode goes out. So September the 20th, there will, at a minimum, September the 20th, there'll be a full episode, then 2 weeks after that, then 2 weeks after that, and so on and so forth. On those off weeks, there may still be a full episode, and in the coming weeks, there probably will be, because I have a number of great conversations that I really need to get out into the world, but there may not be. And on those weeks, it's just a great opportunity to catch up on anything that you might have missed, any episodes that you might have missed. If any of that is at all confusing, simply subscribe and you'll get the latest into whatever device that you use to listen to the show. Speaking of which, check out our new website, www.allthingsrisk.co.uk. There are a number of new features there, including a number of links to all the different platforms that you can get the show on, and you can subscribe to the show, particularly on your Android device. As I mentioned, I get a lot of questions around how people can get podcasts on their Android device. Simply check out allthingsrisk.co.uk and check out any of the apps on the right-hand side of the homepage, and you'll be able to get the show on many different platforms. And also, we're looking to set up a newsletter, so if you go onto the site, you can enter your email address and get features into your inbox and bonus content, some things that I'm working on in the near future. So please check that out. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I want to get into my guest this week because I think the conversation is simply awesome. It's just really great stuff. My guest is Tony Hale. Tony is many things, and many things that initially might seem quite disparate and unrelated. But as soon as you start to listen to Tony speak, you'll see that they're actually very connected. Most recently, Tony was the CEO of a company called Chartbeat, which in and of itself is a fascinating organization. We'll get into them in a moment. Tony has been featured in Time Magazine and Forbes and Salon and other places. And he and I go way back, or we go back to a place called Control Risks, where we both worked for a period of time. Since his time there, Tony's gone on to do some very interesting things. He's been involved in yacht racing, in polar expeditions, including working with Ben Saunders, who's a polar explorer and an endurance athlete. And in recent years, he's been involved in the world of tech startups. At Chartbeat, this company that he co-founded, he was the founding CEO. He worked in the digital media space. And what Chartbeat does, it does something that I really love, and that is to help companies predominantly in the media space understand in a much more nuanced way how their audience interacts with various stories. So moving beyond simply clicks, numbers of clicks on a site, and really trying to answer that question, well, how are people actually engaging with the content? And we get into this in our conversation, and it's just a great and very reassuring part of the conversation, in which through Tony's work, his conclusion really is that many people want long form content that is nuanced, that is deep, that is intellectually stimulating. And all this stuff about clickbait, while it's still around, isn't the be-all and end-all of the web. And it's a very interesting part of the conversation. We talk about a number of fun things. I think, again, you're going to love this. You're going to love this conversation. We get into Tony's background. He spent some time living in the Palestinian West Bank, which is similarly fascinating. We talk about his experiences in polar expeditions, things like traveling up to Siberia, but also a number of the lessons that he took away from those kinds of experiences, particularly around risk, and how he applied those lessons to the world of tech startups. And this is fascinating stuff, because I think a lot of these lessons are applicable to almost anything we do, whether it's a startup or anything else. And it also, I think, challenges the notions that people might have about entrepreneurs, that entrepreneurs are inherently risk-taking people, that they're a bit maverick. When if you listen to how Tony describes the experience, it's actually quite different. It's certainly risk-taking, but much more intelligent risk-taking and much more nuanced and calculated. And I think that there are a number of wonderful lessons that we can all take away from his experience. And in fact, he does share a number of the lessons that he took away as the CEO of Chartbeat. And in addition to all of this stuff, we talk about media. Tony has been involved in leading courses at Columbia and Stanford on media and journalism, which is also really interesting. We have a very good conversation about the future of investigative journalism, for instance. And that's also a theme that runs through the show. And I've had others on the show that have touched on the same topic. So a number of interesting aspects to that conversation. And we also get into his book recommendations. Tony, on his website, has a number of recommendations for books, and he brings a couple of his most recently completed reads, and that's another great aspect of the conversation. We talk about many other things. Tony's very thoughtful, he's funny, he's very cool. I think you're going to really enjoy this. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Tony Hale. Taking the time to speak to me today. Really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You've recently stepped down from your role as CEO of a company called Chartbeat. What do you tell people when they ask you what it is you do? What's to kick things off?
What is it I do now?
Well,
being British, I usually make up some kind of ridiculous remark around being semi-retired. But I mean, the reality is I'm trying to start a new company. So I'm I'm in the midst of creation again, as I guess what I tell people these days. I'm putting together the team. I'm testing the hypothesis and seeing if I'm crazy or not.
Okay. Very cool. What is it that you're creating? Are you in a position to divulge that, or?
I can tell you a little bit about it. I mean, the thing that I've been obsessed with for the last 7 years or so has been the business model of media, because quite frankly, media is in trouble in terms of like sustainable journalism and its ability to pay for itself. Mm. And for all the other things, all the fun things that we can do in that space, if we don't fix the ability of quality journalism to pay for itself, then nothing else really matters. Mm-hmm. And so the new company is taking a kind of consumer-oriented approach towards that.
That's very that's really cool. I've had actually a couple of journalists on my podcast, and one of the things we got into talking about is the state of investigative journalism and the struggles that, you know, the good quality journalism, the struggles of producing good quality journalism because of the business model. And you've got, you know, people like, you've got companies like The Guardian that are in trouble, and it seems like a real struggle. And at the same time, there's a huge, I think there's a huge demand for good quality journalism in different formats. So
there's kind of two interesting data points to that from relatively recently, is at least the first one. So it was announced this week that the U.S. was no longer going to use private prisons. And this was a big thing. And it largely came about after the report of one investigative journalist who was working for Mother Jones, which is a wonderful journalism outfit in America. And the cost to do that investigative report for Mother Jones was around about $350,000. The ad revenue they were able to get from that report was around $5,000. That's quite the delta. And so you have this challenge of how does one pay for this journalism, which is hugely important to our society. One of my favorite quotes is from S.S. McClure. It says, "The vitality of democracy requires popular knowledge of complex ideas." Like, how do you manage to make that happen? And people will say, "Oh, well, you know what? People only care about cats, or they care about this kind of clickbait," and they actually have a very low opinion of people in general. But in some ways, and this is kind of getting back to my metrics background, it comes down to how you count. Because when you look at the data on this front, if you look at 2015, for example, you look at the number one story by page views, by clicks, it was the dress. Is this thing blue and black, or is it white and gold? The number one story by social shares was a story. It was Robert Plant listening to someone else sing one of his songs.
Right.
It's a 4-year-old video, but somehow that became the most socially shared story of the year. But if you look at actually what people are actually reading, if you look at actual attention, so the total amount of time spent with a particular story, then it's something very different. The number one story of 2015 was a piece in The Atlantic called What ISIS Really Wants. And it was long form. It was a fabulous piece of journalism that people devoured, like millions of people devoured and read. I mean, to actually give you some data on this, it got 55 million minutes of engaged time in total on that story, which is roughly the equivalent of getting 400,000 people to watch the new Star Wars movie. So, and that's one article. One article can do that. So when people say people aren't interested in real journalism, they're not interested in investigative stuff, one, they are, if it's written in a way where it's truly powerful and it's put in the right place. But even if they're not interested in that, they're interested in the outcome of that. They're interested in the private prisons being shut down, even if they haven't read the entirety of the story. And so that's why it's important. And it is a challenge, this kind of challenge of how to make sure that we can like support this beyond the kind of largesse of billionaires, like in the case of the Washington Post. How do we have something a little bit more sustainable than philanthropy?
Yeah, there's definitely something going on here. One of the reasons why I started a podcast is because I love podcasts. And I love the long form conversation, because and the long form conversation is something that we're missing, I think, a lot in societies. And but at the same time, you know, podcasting is booming, and there's something going on here. There's a market here, but the business models really haven't caught up. The infrastructure hasn't caught up, and it hasn't really recognized that. And people are searching for things that really speak to intellectual stimulation, in-depth analysis, in-depth conversation. There's definitely a counter trend to all the clickbaity stuff, and I'd love to explore that, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But I'm assuming that you're in agreement with that. But to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the most interesting things is this capacity for us to kind of really explore new formats. And again, this is kind of like, there's been this kind of unnatural constraint, which has kind of a little bit been around kind of business models and so forth, where it's been like, where we've had to, in order to make money from you, show you something else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we like, mm-hmm. like the job of media has been thus far to do everything possible to entice you to a form of media and then make money by how effectively we can distract you from that same piece of media.
Right.
Which is a little crazy when you think about it. But one of the kind of interesting things that you're starting to see with this, and what I'm hopeful for in the future, is that with things like podcasting and so forth, that maybe there's a way for us to kind of break that old contract where we don't have to try and do a bait and switch with your attention, but mm-hmm. we can truly say there's something of value here, and it can be recognized as such. And if the systems are in place, maybe you can do something good. It's but we're a long way from that right now, I would argue.
Mm. Right. Well, your arc is really interesting. So I'd like to just get into your background a little bit first, and sure. you know how you got into doing what you do, what you have done, and what you do, and you know all of that good stuff. But you're a Brit living in New York. Earlier days, I know you studied international relations and you got into media, but what was that? How did that evolve?
It was all very bizarre, to be honest.
You also did polar expeditions and lots of you know epic adventures. So we have to talk about that. Sorry.
Yeah. No. It's definitely not the journey that I thought about when I was young. Mm-hmm. I think when I was kind of in high school, everyone just talked about that you became like a lawyer or an accountant mm-hmm. or something like that. And I've definitely not done either of those things. So I was at St. Andrews studying international relations. And I think my first sense of this was being utterly kind of astounded about how wrong I'd been about so many things, which has mm-hmm. been a fairly constant feeling throughout my life ever since. And realizing that I knew nothing. I mean, like one of the things, for example, was the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, mm-hmm. Where I had the most cursory of perspectives, and then really kind of digging into it and realizing that I really knew nothing about this kind of most complex of issues. Mm. And I was there, and I was trying to study this thing in Scotland, which is a little ways away. Yeah. And so one of the things I decided to do is I started reading up, and I found actually there was a Palestinian university called BizAid. And so I persuaded the university to let me take myself off there for a semester. Mm. And so for a semester, I was living in a Palestinian basement in the West Bank, learning Arabic and kind of seeing, trying to get a perspective on both sides. And that was kind of the key thing for me, because it's so easy when you're kind of like sitting there to try and to just jump from extreme of opinion to other extreme of opinion. And one of the things that was kind of most useful for me was I would spend my evening sitting there with my kind of Palestinian roommate, who was an illegal student from Gaza who had to smuggle himself into the West Bank in order to study. But during the day, often I would kind of try and head into kind of West Jerusalem or something like that, and I'd sit with kind of with groups of people who are either trying to do outreach or talking about other perspectives, like Israeli families who'd lost children thanks to the conflict. And so that gave me, it did kind of two things to me. One, it was an incredible experience in being able to do that, and something which just stayed with me. I can still swear in Arabic pretty well. But also it was kind of like, I think it was the first time that I'd really taken on something that other people would consider to be a risk. Cause it was during the closures. I would call home every time there was a kind of suicide bombing, in order to get to university. We would often be kind of, you'd drive up in one taxi to a wall, you'd clamber over the wall. There'd be another taxi on the other side. Right. There were military checkpoints everywhere. It was, and there were protests. It was kind of, certainly my parents considered it a high risk situation.
Sure. I can imagine.
So I got a certain appreciation for that. So anyway, I was there in St. Andrews, came back to St. Andrews, got my master's degree there, and then promptly did nothing with that degree because I went off and became a bowman on Around the World Yacht Race for the next year or so. So I was sailing around the world and not really knowing what I was going to do with my international relations degree when I came back, because the main thing that it had been useful for thus far was winning arguments in pubs. Then I came back, and about 2 months later, 9/11 happened.
Right.
And suddenly, someone with a master's in international relations who could speak Palestinian Arabic became handy, and I joined Control Risks as a lowly editor. and was there all the way through the kind of the beginnings of the Iraq War until kind of early 2004. When I for a long time I hadn't been able to kind of get that adventure side of me out. There was unfinished business from the yacht race, and so I found myself in the world of polar expeditions in typically bizarre fashion.
Right. I wanted to actually dive in a little bit on a couple things, because I think I see a connection between the sailing around the world, the polar expeditions, and then your experience in Palestine. I think going off and studying in the Middle East, and you know, studying the Israeli-Palestinian conflict up front, it's not many people do that kind of thing. And one of the things I imagine, but you can let me know if this is correct or not, but it makes it very, very real. You're getting right to the edge of that experience. You interacted with people, you know, on both sides, and it became very real and, you know, kind of very, very visceral. I similarly imagine that, you know, sailing around the world, there's an element of risk to it, but also you're living and breathing the experience in much the same way. And I can kind of see how you would, you know, how you'd want to do both things.
Yeah, it's I think if there's been a kind of a guiding philosophy in my life, it's been trying to kind of break out of homeostasis. Mm-hmm. It's been saying there is this general kind of comfort zone that we live in, and it's not really about a desire to be uncomfortable or anything like that. One of my favorite quotes from my very first skipper was, "Any fool can be uncomfortable." It was more about saying, I want to kind of if I want to understand a bit more about the world and about myself, I have this briefest of moments that I get to be in this world, and I want to try and learn as much about it and about myself as possible. And each one of these experiences, by kind of pushing me away from homeostasis, by making me confront fundamentally different cultures to my own, fundamentally different perspectives to my own, putting me in situations which were at times terrifying, and certainly made me, and there were times which caused me to reflect very deeply on my own kind of like character failings, were incredibly powerful.
Right.
And people always think that my path has been strange, from kind of like round the world yacht racing to polar expeditions to kind of to CEO. But in many ways, I feel there's been a very common thread.
I can start to see how those things connect a little bit anyway. Sailing around the world was just very curious about this. Were you a sailor before you got into it?
By the time I decided to do it, I'd done very little sailing in the past. I'd done one leg of the Tall Ships race and so forth. And it was about 3 years before the race was going off. Mm-hmm. And I saw that they were looking for crew. It was one of the strangest things, because if you ask me why I decided that I wanted to do it, I have 1,000 reasons. Mm-hmm. But all of those reasons I came up with after I decided to do it. And so... It's one of these things that apparently you see in psychology a lot, is that a lot of the times our reasons for the decisions we make are post facto rationalizations. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly true for me. It was literally just I shall do this. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 3 years basically in every single spare vacation that I had from university or anything like that, I was down working on boats in Southampton. I was delivering boats across the Atlantic. I was doing whatever I could to get the skills necessary in order to do the job that I did. And luckily, my job was on the bow.
Mm.
And basically, when you're on a 72-foot, 42-ton racing yacht, your job on the bow is largely about taking huge amounts of punishment.
Yeah, right.
And that I could do. I would argue that the people who grew up sailing dinghies and kind of light small boats are far more gifted sailors than I will ever be, even though I may have more miles on them. I was definitely on the kind of brute force and vigor side of sailing in that context.
Right. Okay. So you transition then back from the world of sailing through to the world of international political risk analysis and consulting, and then all the way over to Arctic expeditions.
Yeah, it'd been something where, like, I started reading about Shackleton and so forth on my during my yacht racing days, and there was still one thing for me, like, there was still this knowledge that during the yacht race that if I truly wanted to, at some point I could have just said, I'm not going up on deck, I'm gonna, like, stay in my sleeping bag strapped in, I'm gonna let everyone else do the work, and like, I could have still got around. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I wouldn't have been very popular, but I could have got around. I could have at least finished the leg.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking for something that was kind of a greater test of myself, of my individual ability. And in some ways, I couldn't think of anything harder than polar expeditions. and reading that, and also the kind of British history of it, was something where it got to the point where I started just writing to the people who'd written some of the books about polar expeditions and saying, hey, you know what, I did this yacht race. Mm-hmm. I've never been on skis in my life, but how hard can that be? take me with you, until one of them finally did. And then I was very lucky in 2003 to kind of meet up with a guy called Ben Saunders. Mm-hmm. Who's a phenomenal friend and inspiration, and we became teammates. And then when we managed to get our first major sponsorship deal, I regretfully left Control Risk and a lot of good friends, and kicked off on the polar expeditions. And
this
is the world of ice.
2004.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it true? Because I saw something that is it true that the airline that takes you in Siberia to where you started your expedition was called Crash Air? Is that
yeah, it's kind of like it's Krasnoyarsk Air, which is known as it's KRAS Air,
okay.
But it's just Crash Air. and it's the kind of the traditional joke among old Russia hands.
Right.
But yeah, it's quite an airline. There's your in-flight meal is an apple and some vodka, and the pilots are there kind of smoking next to the fuel can. And it promotes a certain kind of fatalistic view of life at that point.
Very, very cool. What were the kind of the biggest takeaways or things that you learned? I mean, did you have a longer term plan other than you want to do these expeditions, or it was just, I want to do these expeditions and see how it goes, and then we'll see what happens after that.
I don't know if I've ever been someone who's ever had a life plan beyond like this desire to kind of like test myself in new interesting ways. I still would argue I don't have a life plan, which is something my wife will have a go at me about sometimes. Back in those days, there was I've been always a big believer in setting kind of huge, almost unattainable goals. And there was this one, the reason I got into polar expeditions in part was there was this one journey, this one unfinished journey, which was since 1912, when Robert Falcon Scott and his team died returning from the South Pole. No one had ever walked from the South Coast, from the coast of Antarctica to the South Pole and back again. No one had achieved that. For all the stories that we get every year of people standing at the South Pole waving flags and so forth, most of them had been kind of flown in the first few hundred miles. They go one way and they get picked up. There are a few great journeys which are often attempted crossings, so like Rand Fiennes and Mike Stroud attempted a crossing and got to the Ross Ice Shelf, if not to the coast, on a fabulous journey that they did. But no one had done this one thing that Scott had tried and died doing. Mm. And so that seemed like a big thing. So for many years, that was the goal. That was the thing that we were working towards. Mm-hmm. And I never got there. Mm. So I managed to get distracted by startups, but my teammate Ben, who showed far greater fidelity to the cause than I did, in 2012 with Tarka, who is Tarka Le Penier, who's another great expeditioner and definitely a far better person to have on the expedition than me. They both actually did this journey, and they did the first return journey to the South Pole, and right. It was a phenomenal feat, and in which I got to participate a little bit as their kind of backup expedition manager. Right. But yeah, so that was always the kind of the grand goal, and it's one I signally failed to do.
And is it called the Scott Expedition? Is that right?
Yeah, that was the Scott Expedition. Back in the day, we were just calling it the South, in part because we managed to persuade someone to give us south.com, which was awesome. That was the grand dream. And it's one of those interesting things, though, isn't it? Which is that you said a huge impossible dream, or near impossible. Ben has obviously proved that it's not impossible. You said this huge near unattainable dream, and even in failing to get to that, which I did, I still got to experience so many more things than if I'd set up a mine to go. I got to stand at the North Pole. I got to see the Northern Lights. I got to build a runway in Greenland. I got to negotiate with vodka-fueled helicopter pilots in Siberia, using Viagra as a bribe. I got to do 1,000 things that, again, took me away from that homeostasis. That despite having kind of failed to reach that goal, fully enriched my life.
Mm-hmm. I can kind of see the connection to startups, because you know you're doing these huge unattainable goals are all about doing things that no one's ever done before. So there's not necessarily a model, a template that you can follow. And to succeed in I'm presuming to succeed in the startup world, it's very much the same thing. To make it big, you're trying to create something that hasn't been done before, to tap markets that are only emerging. So I can only imagine that gave you a lot of tools. I don't know if you had some time to reflect on that some of the different
There's kind of two things that really do come across. One is that it's not just a kind of goal for yourself when it comes to startups and kind of giving yourself this kind of huge thing that you want to try and attain. It's the it's how you have to persuade a group of people to do something clearly against their own kind of self-interest, which is you have a bunch of people, including like incredibly well-paid engineers working at stable, great companies like, say, Google or Facebook. Mm-hmm. And you have to say, hey, I want you to come and take a massive pay cut with where if we look at rationally from a kind of from the kind of statistics of startup success, you have a very low shot of making of making more money in the long term. Mm-hmm. But come do this thing with me, and if we do it, we can maybe just make it the kind of change in the world that we want to see. And so there's setting out that kind of vision, which is one thing. But the other thing that really kind of comes through, both from kind of from sailings, in fact, from pretty much everything I've done from sailing, from expeditions, and from my time in the Middle East and so forth, is you set out your plan, which is all very well, and that will last you about the first 24 hours.
Right.
Because you are in a hugely complex and shifting environment. And literally when you're up on the Arctic Ocean, the ice is shifting beneath you. You have no idea if you're going to wake up tomorrow to a flat pan of ice, or whether there's going to be kind of mountains of rubble in front of you, whether you'll have drifted back the distance that you skied the day before. Like, all of these things exist to change. You don't know what piece of equipment is going to break, because apart from knowing for the fact that everything breaks when you're on an expedition. And so there's this willingness to be utterly flexible in terms of how you get to that thing. You have this grand goal, but assuming that it will all work in this kind of very kind of regimented march and a straight line towards the goal is just utterly superficial and wrong. And in startups, in some ways, people, like, I've seen people get like frustrated because their plans aren't working, and that's where you have to encourage them to kind of have a plan, but have a plan as something which you know that you will deviate from. And it's the deviating when you still, it's like, I tell people, it's like going from New York to Boston. There's the straightest route, but you never know if there's going to be road works. You never know what's going to happen. And you have to be able to prepare to kind of take the side road every so often. As long as you still know that your job is to get to Boston, it doesn't really matter like the twists and turns that it took you to get there. You just want to make sure you get there. The only thing that's important is kind of the goal. And so that certainly is like viscerally true in expeditions, and is definitely true in the world of startups.
You have to be very comfortable with uncertainty, which most people are not.
Yeah, I mean, it's something where people often kind of overestimate, I know, the impact of bad things happening sometimes on this front, or they haven't perfectly worked out their base. And by that I mean, like, so one of the great things actually about polar expeditions around the world you're racing, and even to a certain extent political and security risk consulting, is that the one thing in common that all those three things have is that the pay is incredibly bad. Because in each one of these things you're doing it because you love to do that thing, and people know. And so I lived on very, very little money for most of my 20s, and yet I was perfectly happy. I was very, very happy. And that has actually been one of the kind of things that's kind of helped me along. When I left Chartbeat at the beginning of the year to begin something new, it was kind of a seminal time in my kind of family life. There was lots of things happening, and you could expect a certain amount of, some people told me the normal reaction would have been to kind of like do the more conservative path. But for me, the advantage that I had was having been so broke for so long and knowing what that was like, I was like, you know what? If everything goes tits up, I'm still fine.
Yes.
Because I can be perfectly happy making just a few dollars a year, living in this way, and so forth. And that, in some ways, gives you a comfort that no matter what level of uncertainty you're dealing with, you're still kind of within the zone of comfort in that regard. Where you're pushing yourself out of that zone of comfort is in terms of like your ideas about the world, how much you can affect it, whether you're kind of right in some of your in some of your kind of forecasts about what's going to happen, and so forth. But yeah, I feel like I don't really take very many risks, even though other people can think I do. Because it's all fairly calculated, and it's all relatively based upon like what's the worst that could happen. Not that bad.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight, and also a very good lesson to not get, number one, I suppose, is not get too comfortable or too used to your surroundings. And I like the thought process of, you know, yeah, if everything goes tits up, then what's the worst that could happen? And I think that's a really useful process to just think about that. And if everything, you know, goes tits up, and if you think it through, actually, oftentimes, I think, you know, most of us would be fine in one way or the other, at least in, you know, if we're living in Western Europe or North America.
Yeah, we have a pretty good safety cushion. And this is one of those things. I mean, to your point, the importance of kind of thinking things through in advance and trying to kind of accurately gauge what these things really are kind of really comes through in a bunch of different ways when you're dealing in environments like this. Now, I remember actually one, and it's a little bit of a tangent, but on the one of the many lessons that I learned on the race was there was this one day deep in the Southern Ocean, and there were kind of four of us huddled on the kind of windward side on the kind of high side of the boat, dealing with kind of the waves kind of crashing over us, and we were kind of hooked on to the boat when our skipper came up from below decks just to check on everyone. And he was inside this kind of like this kind of safe cockpit area, or relatively safe cockpit area, and so he hadn't clipped on himself just yet. He was just coming up very quickly for a thing, and a rogue wave came and took him and threw him across to the bottom side of the boat, and he was in danger of kind of going overboard, which is definitely a careless thing to do. One should not lose one skipper on a race. And the four of us all reacted instantaneously, but with one of us doing something different, because three of us jumped forward and immediately were caught by our safety cords. And so we were kind of, it was almost like the dogs in Tom and Jerry cartoons, at the kind of the end of their leashes, scrabbling to get forward in this panic to get to him, but hadn't really thought through. Only one of us, this guy called Glenn, who's this amazing chap, had been thinking like, okay, if this, and what he said afterwards was, I'm always trying to think through what if.
Right.
And so he said, like, okay, this guy's coming out. He hasn't clipped on. What if he goes? The first thing I need to do is unclip my own harness, reclip over there, and then go and get him. And because of that, he was several seconds faster than us and made the difference. And that really kind of struck home with me as a kind of always just be kind of like scenario planning as you go. And then kind of like as I... And nowadays, I still like in a kind of more formal way. I kind of stole a lot of good lessons from my time at Control Risks. I still run people through impact likelihood matrices whenever I'm looking at the kind of at the world, and the things that I'm looking for are kind of like what are the triggers that we should be assessing as we go forward? What are the kind of mitigation strategies that we can do? What are the response strategies we can do? Do we have them? Have we thought these things through beforehand? And those things are just as handy when you're dealing with the world of startups as it is when you're trying to kind of keep people safe in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, I mean that's super useful thinking. I mean, just going back to your comment about you don't know what the ice is going to look like when you wake up, and the usefulness of plans or lack thereof when people, things deviate from plan. I love that. I think it was an Eisenhower quote that goes that all plans are useless, but planning is invaluable.
Yes.
Or something like that. But it's just that practice of thinking through the what ifs, the exact situation. You'll never think of what the exact situation is that will happen, but it's just that practice of thinking it through, and then you've got the tools at your disposal to respond effectively.
Yeah, it's a really big thing. I think one of the things that happens, especially, is that certainly in crisis situations, you don't have the time, and it's often very, very difficult to kind of think things through in a kind of calm and reasonable fashion.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so it's just much, much easier to have kind of thought this through beforehand. And even if it's not quite like the thing that you're facing, it's that practice, it's that habit, it's the processes that you've thought through beforehand that make it much, much easier. So and that's how you seem calm when everyone else is kind of running around like chickens.
Yes.
It's not any special kind of superhero quality. It's just you spend time thinking about it beforehand.
Yeah, it's a practice like any other. And it's really interesting that you apply that to the world of startups, because again, and just going back to your comment about, well, people think that what you've done is incredibly risky, but to you it isn't. And I, the same thing, I think I've never worked in the world of startups, but I can, I know what the perception is like, that this is, a bunch of risk takers and mavericks and people that are at times a little bit reckless, but that's, they go for that risk reward return, when I think what you're talking about is something much more calculated and much better thought through than I think the common perception of a lot of these things.
Yeah, I think there's a big difference that people sometimes conflate between risk taking and being reckless.
Yes.
Risk taking is something which is thought through, where you've looked at the probabilities and you said, whilst the future is uncertain, I feel confident enough that I've kind of mitigated enough of the major risks. I have this much of a cushion over here where I can do this, and I have a shot at a good return. Reckless is kind of when you've ignored that process.
Yes.
And it's tricky. So one of the things that really brought it home for me, it was actually during polar expeditions, mm-hmm. and there were and the people that do polar expeditions in general are a strange bunch. There's very few people, and so everyone tends to know each other. And we were out in Siberia, where I was actually managing an expedition for Ben, who was going to attempt a solo crossing of the Arctic, which mm-hmm. which is a phenomenally hard thing to do. And there was a few different people attempting different kinds of expeditions, and you're all in this this town called Katanga, which is effectively the arse end of the universe, and you're hanging around kind of waiting for the weather to be right and for the people in Vladivostok to stop fighting with the people in Novosibirsk so that you can get your plane to the right place in the Novaya Zemlya,
right?
And so forth. And one of the things that happened in that time was that the ice for the first 20 kilometers off the shore of this kind of northernmost point of land had started to become very thin and very kind of broken in a way that was dangerous. And for a certain group of people, there's maybe there's a couple of thousand people in the world for whom the exact start point of your expedition is vital in order for them to consider it a real expedition.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else, it's like, my God, you spent 6 weeks walking across the kind of frozen, moving crust of the Arctic Ocean on your own to get to the North Pole. That's the most kind of phenomenal thing in the world. And people were faced with this very real decision, which was there's this area which is fundamentally dangerous in a way beyond the normal parameters of risk and danger mm-hmm. in expedition. Do I start from here and make those 2,000 people happy with me, mm-hmm. or do I take a helicopter across to the first safe point of start?
Sure.
About 20 kilometers in, and start from there and still do this incredible journey and go for it. And there was some very heated debate with different teams, and two people decided that they were actually going to go off from that classic start point. And I remember watching them go walk off in the distance, and the reason why that memory is still so strong with me is because I was one of the last people to see them alive.
Wow!
Within 24 hours, one of them was dead, wow. And the other one had one of the luckiest escapes ever. They'd fallen through the ice, and the challenge, of course, when you fall through the ice is when you're above the ice, you're on skis, so your weight is distributed across the ski. But if you get into kind of thin ice and you break through, suddenly you're trying to get out, and your hands are much more concentrated for areas for your weight. So it's very, very hard once you're in to get out. You're in right. intensely cold water. You're going in very quickly into hypothermic shock. Luckily, one of these guys was kind of ex-military. He got frostbite on all his hands, his feet, across his chest, which is pretty rare. But we managed to get a helicopter to him, and he survived. But within 24 hours, their expeditions were over.
Mm-hmm.
All the things they wanted to achieve, all the things they wanted to learn about themselves, mm-hmm. all the things they wanted to do had been sacrificed in some ways for this one thing. Now the 2,000 people will say, well, you know, that was they could argue that that was the pure way to go. I would argue that was an utterly reckless way to go, in that you have maybe 20 goals that you want to achieve from any kind of expedition that are both kind of internal and personal and so forth, and you're going to have to sacrifice some of them.
Yes.
Because that's the nature of any kind of complex project, and when you start moving from calculated risk into pure recklessness, that's, you know, something is very, very wrong with how you are approaching these things. And so that's always been the kind of the barrier for me. Like, I'm a big fan of risk. I'm less a fan of being reckless.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's obviously a very real lesson, very tragic lesson. And for me, one of the rules of thumb is the risk I'm taking irreversible and dramatic, you know, dramatic and irreversible. And if it is, then it gives me pause. Whereas, you know, I'm looking actually for the other way of doing it, which is, you know, if I can easily rebound from it, but there's huge upside, then that's a risk worth taking. But interesting and obviously tragic story. But one, I mean, that really illustrates the point.
I like that dramatic and irreversible perspective. I think my wife would argue the only time that I've really done that was when I married her. and we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure the upside's you know, huge, off the charts.
It is indeed.
I did want to get into your transition into the world of startups and the world of digital media and this company Chartbeat. I'm sure many of your followers obviously know, you know, all about Chartbeat, but many of my listeners probably don't. So it would be interesting to just get your interested in your story into how you transitioned from that into the world of startups and to getting involved in Chartbeat, which is really interesting company in terms
Thank
of what
you.
They do.
Sure. So it was all rather bizarre, in fact, and it wasn't something that was like, it wasn't part of the plan. It was an adaptation of environment that kind of led me down a path. So there I was in New York City, actually looking for money for a polar expedition, when a friend of mine had another friend who knew that I was a kind of closet geek. I like to kind of like play with tech and so forth in my spare time, and they were looking at investing in this company, and they sent me the business plan. Just say, hey, you know what? Just give us your thoughts on this. And between expeditions, you're basically kind of either raising money or just kind of making money to make ends meet, which and sometimes can be very, very kind of like manual labor. It can be very kind of I've bartended an awful lot over the years, and so forth. And so I had a lot of spare time at this moment in time. So instead of just like saying, oh yeah, this looks cool, I wrote 6 pages of notes about why I thought this idea sucked and what they should be doing differently. I've always been a bit opinionated. I thought it was just going back to these friends. They sent it around all these people in Silicon Valley who came back and said, if you're so smart, do you want to come help run this thing? And I was like, well, it's like 4 months until expedition season. I'll give this a shot. It'll help me kind of like pay for my living expenses until then. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't Chartbeat. That was my first startup, one called Chimp.
Okay.
And it turned into a kind of a complete disaster. By the way, I launched a coup against the CEO, which failed. I was summarily fired, and my team all pulled out, and the company kind of collapsed. But it was an amazing learning experience. But that kind of like brought me into startups. Mm-hmm. And then I was in New York. I didn't have the world's best immigration status, I met these great people at a place called BetaWorks who originally kind of showed. We were talking about me working on one company where I was going to be like a COO type for an app store for Twitter, which in the end I chose not to do. And in the meantime, I kind of met this guy Billy Chasen, who'd built this incredible service called Firefly, where with Firefly you could see. When you went to a website, you could see the mouse cursors of all the other people who were visiting that same site. So they were moving around like fireflies, as it were, and you could chat with those people. So Business Insider called this a more ADD version of Twitter, if that's possible. but the challenge with this was that the number one use case was that someone would see someone else's cursor on the screen, and they would take their cursor, and they would go over and then they would try and hump it. And that was never going to be a billion-dollar business. Mm. But it turned out people really liked seeing who was on their site. So Billy had started building out this prototype of this thing, which he called Chartbeat. And he needed someone to basically get him Diet Coke and be kind of a GM of this thing. So they kind of put us together, and we kind of kicked off. And this was kind of actually on April Fool's Day of 2009, which should have been my first clue. And so there we were, two of us. And Billy actually, about 4 days later, went off to India and basically kind of transitioned out of Chartbeat. Over time, he's still a great friend. He's still the creative genius that was the kind of the first person there. But he basically kind of from the first week or two in, I was basically on my own with this thing, trying to work out what the hell this business should be. And through lots of kind of twists and turns, I kind of turned this into a kind of a media analytics service. So think of it as like a kind of Bloomberg terminal, but for media companies. So if I'm at the New York Times or I'm at CNN, I have a second screen next to my computer, which is showing me constantly, okay, right now there's 300,000 people on my site. Most of them are interested in this particular story. Mm-hmm. They're scrolling about 2/3 of the way down. About 40% of them came in from Facebook on mobile. And think a little bit like kind of Google Analytics on crack, like super, super fast, constantly updating, right, and giving the kind of, it's kind of like a kind of cockpit into how they're interacting with their audience. And so kind of built that out, and now it has about an 80% market share in the US and is in about 60 countries around the world.
Wow.
So it's come along quite nicely. Despite my leadership, I think.
Quite nicely sounds like an understatement, to be honest, but
it's definitely been fun. I was when I kind of stepped back earlier this year after 7 years, it was let's just say when I was saying goodbye to the team, my allergies were certainly acting up during that time. There may have been moisture leaking from various parts of my face. It was an incredible journey, and they now have my old COO, who we got the chance to promote to CEO, who'd worked with me for 3 years, is now CEO, and he's doing a fabulous job.
Right. One of the things I really like about it is about the company and what it does. And I'm no tech person, I'm no analytics person, but just the idea of shifting the focus from just, you know, clicks and page views to what people are actually looking at on sites.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, that sort of page view thing, and you know, when you click on some clickbaity thing, and it sort of sounds kind of interesting, and then it's, you know, the top 10, you know, whatever. And then, you know, to get to, you know, from number 10 to number 9 and so on, you've got to click on another, you know, another link. And it's just, you know, just for somebody to record a whole bunch of clicks is, you know, it seems like it, versus what you're trying to do, which is like, well, let's actually see how we can get people to engage in the content, or not how we can get people to engage in the content, but how we can understand how people engage with the content. Which, you know, goes back to our earlier, you know, the conversation we had at the beginning about, you know, just about content, about the quality of journalism, which is very badly needed.
It's one of these strange things, in that, like, for like 2 decades or so, we treated the click as being a proxy for someone having read everything on a page.
Yeah.
And the problem with it was kind of twofold. One was that wasn't true. So 55% of all clicks get less than 15 seconds of attention on the page. But also, it kind of helped to lead to this business model where effectively the most rational economic actions you can take if you're a media company is to have a page with a really provocative headline that you click on, which leads to nothing other than another page with a really provocative headline and an ad and so forth. This is where we get kind of slideshows and clickbait and so forth. Mm-hmm. There is no actual economic value to you reading what's on the page. Mm-hmm. We don't want you to read. We want you just to click in that situation. And that One I felt was kind of like fundamentally bad for the long-term success of media, but also this idea that the click was a proxy for reading was just wrong. When you actually look at the data, it's fascinating. So one of the first pieces of kind of in-depth analysis we did was we looked across, and we were seeing, like as I said, like we're seeing pretty much all kind of behavior across all the major media sites, and we pulled out all the most clicked-on terms across all these sites, mm-hmm. And then we separated them into two groups: most clicked on and most read, so where people clicked and then read the story, and then most clicked on and least read, so where they clicked and then they almost immediately bailed. So, and all of the terms got pretty much the same amount of clicks, but the experience was fundamentally different. Mm-hmm. And on the most clicked and least read, you had top, richest, biggest, fictional colleges. You had all those things you expect to see in kind of clickbaity headlines. And on the most clicked and most read, you had Syria, you had Zimmerman, George Zimmerman, you had Obamacare, you had all of these things that were actually of import. And it really did kind of restore my faith in humanity a little. It's that if we start looking through the prism of what people are actually reading, then we see that our audience isn't this group of dumb people. They're smart, engaged people who do actually want to read about things of import if we write them in the right way. Mm-hmm. And so one of the big fights that I tried to kind of pursue whilst at Chartbeat was trying to say, okay, like, it's not about rejecting all data, as some people were kind of very keen to do. It's about trying to find data that can tell us the most accurate story. Because when we have faith in our audience and we try to look for that accurate data, then good things come out. It turns out that they are the kind of people that we want to be speaking to. And that was always the desire for me, to kind of like make the mirror a little bit more clear.
It's also very, as you say, it's very reassuring that, you know, it isn't, you know, people aren't just immediately diving into, I don't know, the one wealth secret that they don't want you to know, or you know, whatever it is. I just going back to one of the things that somebody should come up with is something for podcasts, because podcast stats are very very, very basic. I can't really get, you know, I can get how many listens I've had, but I don't know if that's 10 seconds or the whole episode or specific parts of the episode. But at any rate, I think that there are all these other forms of media that are emerging, that are gaining in popularity, and they largely remain untapped. They're a little bit at odds or at war with the world of clickbait, which I think, you know, it hasn't gone away, has it? I mean, it's still a problem.
Clickbait is alive and well, and will be whilst we value it effectively. And it's when you still have the majority of advertising being paid on a CPM basis, where all it is about, like, if your ad loaded in a viewable part of the page, then you make money. Mm. And for that ad to be viewable is now considered 50% of the ad has to be in the viewable part of the page for 1 second. Mm-hmm. That's the standard. So if you can get 1 second, then you're good. And whilst that's the case, then clickbait will be alive and well.
Yeah, unfortunately. Okay. Well, I did want to get into wrapping up soon, but one of the things I wanted to ask you was just around some of the biggest lessons that you had as a CEO. I mean, what were some of the things that you one or two things maybe that you took away that really stayed with you, much like your polar expeditions?
Yeah, it's tough in some ways. There's a thousand things, and you kind of often end up kind of writing maxims to yourself almost on these things. A few things for me is in many ways, once you get past there's the early stage of the startup, where even as a CEO you're still kind of like an individual actor, because you're going out, you're kind of closing that first deal, you're the person answering all those support requests yourself, you're doing all that kind of stuff. And as the company progresses, you become someone who becomes effective through others, through kind of basically kind of unblocking them or leveraging them to do more. And that's kind of a few key lessons for me on that one. One is the and probably the main one is the importance of shutting up. So often when you're a CEO or you're a manager, or at least the senior person in the room, even sometimes there's something called the HIPPO, which is the highest paid person's opinion.
Right. Yeah.
And there's often this kind of like implicit pressure that you feel in order to kind of to say something to try and add value in the meeting. Often when you have nothing really that great to add, or you're just kind of reframing what someone else said, but then taking credit for the thought, even though you don't think you're doing that, you really are. And so one of the greatest lessons that I got, and actually I got this from a 360 review where people criticized me for doing this, and 360 reviews are wonderful for this. They're like, they're heartbreaking, but amazing, was learning how to just be quiet in a meeting. And at the end, just say, thank you. And if you didn't have something good to add, do that. And then the kind of the counterpoint to that as well was that in terms of you always want to have a culture of kind of hearty disagreement in some ways. If people agree on everything, then generally they're redundant. And so kind of the two things that that were important for me was, one, kind of assuming positive intent with everyone. You assume that everyone genuinely wants the best for the company. No one's trying to do this for kind of political purposes. Now for a few people it may be true, but in general, by assuming positive intent and having people know that you assume positive intent, your impact on the business will be far greater than the deleterious impact of like trying to weed out the kind of the politics.
Figure out whose agenda is what and that kind of thing.
It's like the energy you spend is just not worth it. And the second part of it, a part of that, is in terms of how to disagree. So most people, when you disagree with someone, what they don't hear is a reasoned and cogent argument why an alternate position might be appropriate. They hear, you didn't listen to me when I was speaking. That is the number one thing that most people get when you disagree with them, which is why you can have these kind of long, drawn-out arguments. And I found there's pretty much only really one way in which to have an effective disagreement with someone, which is, one, you have to listen to them until they are completely done. You cannot interrupt them. You've got to kind of let them exhaust themselves with their argument until they're done. Feel free to kind of ask questions to make sure that you understand everything about it. And the second thing you have to do is you have to be able to precede this back to them in such an elegant way where they go, wow, I never truly understood my own position until this one moment because of the clarity with which you expressed it. Yes, that's exactly the position that I'm getting across. And only when you have done that can you really bring up your counterpoint of an alternate position, because your job is not to win this argument. Your job is to come to some kind of conclusion with and have everyone on board with doing that thing. And so if the first thing you do is they absolutely understood that you truly understand the nuances of what they're saying, and then have an alternate approach, they're much more willing to listen. They're much, much more likely to get through. And those were kind of like, I think, some of the biggest things for me. It's so much of it is about communication. When you become a CEO.
Those are really great lessons. I mean, I really like the last one about about listening to people and changing people's minds, because sometimes the argument, even if it's between two intelligent people and they're putting forward good points, it comes down to fifth grade, I'm right. No, you're not. I'm right. No, you're not. And you're not cutting through that. People are people, and they've got their very basic need to be right. And, you need to understand that. Really great lessons. I love those. I just wanted to, finish off with a little bit around what next. I mean, I read your post on why you decided to step down as a CEO, and I can kind of see why, just knowing your background. You love that sort of that kind of startup place, that risk taking place, and I guess as the company's matured, it's been less about that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I mean, there's like Chartbeat's in a relatively strong position now. It still has several challenges, and the job in some ways, the great thing about the job of CEO is that it kind of changes with every new hire you bring on. And certainly in the case of Chartbeat, every time we hired another person, that was the most number of people I had ever managed in my entire life. Going up from like day one all the way through for the last 7 years. And so you were always learning something, but I was missing a little bit of that kind of early startup experience of doing it. And it'd been a while since I'd done that. And there was also just an idea I couldn't get out of my head. And it was one that if I had tried to do it within Chartbeat, it would have been utterly the wrong position to do. It would have been very, very difficult, and it would have probably destroyed more value than it created. But as an independent company, it could make some sense. Right. And so I didn't want to do that to a company that I loved, and I realized that this was in some ways a sign to myself that I'd got to that stage where it was time for me to kind of get back to the kind of the way I was in the beginning, taking on a bit more risk, you know, cutting my salary by two thirds, and seeing if I could create something again. And also the good thing for me was knowing that I had a fabulous team that I've been lucky enough to kind of build over the years, and so Chartbeat would be in strong, arguably better hands without my fooling around. And so it was that combination of in some ways, yeah, I had mitigated the risks of my own departure by having a team and a great COO who I had complete confidence in, and his ability to lead. And this desire to kind of like to get back to the business of kind of creation.
Right.
So it was, yeah, it was a little bit of both.
Right. Right. It sounds like a decision well considered and well made. I'm just curious. You've got on your LinkedIn profile that you're an adjunct professor at Stanford in media and technology. Is that and also that you've done the same thing at Columbia? So I'm very curious as to what you're, you know, what that's about and what you're teaching there.
Sure. Yeah, I've just been coming up with the syllabus for the course at Stanford over the last week or two. So I'm back at Columbia. Emily Bell, who used to be the managing editor of the Guardian Online and who's now a professor at the Tao School at Columbia, she asked me to come and do and run a course with her on digital strategies for newsrooms at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia, which is the Pulitzer School. It's a fabulous school. And when Emily asks you something, you never say no. And so I got to have a great time teaching with her over that period. And
sure.
Then Stanford wanted to do a course on media technology and change, the rise of platforms and all of these things of how this world is kind of changing. And they asked Bill Gruskin, who was the dean of Columbia Journalism School until relatively recently, and he reached out and asked if I would teach the course with him. And so the two of us are putting ideas together, and we're trying to come up with an interesting and provocative course for students. And the main thing that the main reason why I do this stuff, well, there's two reasons. One, my parents love being able to put it in their Christmas letter, and two, I get to stand in front of a group of incredibly smart students and throw out kind of ideas or thoughts or theories and have them kind of test and rip them apart and come up with their own things. And
sure.
that kind of intellectual hothouse is incredible for kind of advancing my own thinking.
Yeah.
And so from a purely selfish perspective, it's great fun.
Very cool. Where do you think aspiring journalists should be looking to? Maybe this is not an easy question to answer, but you know, the sort of A good friend of mine who I had on the show, he loved journalism and just kind of classic newspapers. And he came up with a term called "I'm a newspaperist." So I'm an old school journalist, and I look at content and I look at sources and I write the story, and that's a bit of a dying art. If you were sort of a I don't know, 22-year-old aspiring journalist, where would you direct people who have some aspirations of doing good journalistic work?
Well, it's tricky. There are any number of places that are still doing amazing journalistic work. Mm. I mean, the classics like the Times. Mm. Like I said, like example, some of the new ones like Mother Jones mm-hmm. has done good work. There's ProPublica. Who's doing incredible investigative journalism on that side of things. There's a bunch of places which are doing great journalism. The challenge in some ways is that there are many, many fewer places than there were, and especially when it comes to a kind of lifeblood of local journalism, like the local papers and their ability to cover City Hall and so forth is drastically reduced. And this is a significant problem. And as I said, like I think we need more and better and motivated journalists in the future. People who really care about the story. And we have this great tradition of that from so many publications. And we can't have that disappear. The challenge in some ways for people like me is to make sure that we can afford it. Mm-hmm. So I'd say to journalists, like try, like being a newspaperist is in spirit is absolutely the right thing to do. Being it in practice, where you if you just disregard the future of digital and so forth, is possibly not very sustainable. Mm. And so trying to find a way to find a sustainable way in which to create good journalism, where you're thinking through business models is important. And then also hope like hell that people like me can try and find more ways for you to get paid.
Right.
That's really the kind of core of it.
Right. Right. Two more things, to ask you, Tony.
Sure.
The first one is just actually extending that same question to yourself. Like if you were able to give yourself, your 20-year-old self, a little bit of advice, what are some of the things you might say to your 20-year-old Tony?
Wow, a lot of things. Mainly dating advice, I think. I think so, in some ways, like even like just be a touch more bold, as it were. I think there are times when fear of failure kind of held me back from things. Also my pursuit of perfection, I think, in my 20s. Mm. Certainly, I think, like, if I'd realized earlier that perfect was the enemy of done, I would have had an even richer experience. And so I think that is the thing. There is, you will have an idea, you will have a goal, and it's okay to kind of like adapt that goal as you go, in order to kind of maximize what you're really going for, which is to use every last second of this short and wonderful life in the richest, most fulfilling way possible. And I think that would have been a kind of useful lesson for 20-year-old me.
Right, right. That's great. I love the point about perfection. I think it resonates with me now. Not just when I was 20. That's great. And then finally, Tony, you have I love your book recommendations. Your list of top books. So I was just wondering what are you reading now, and what have you read lately that you quite like?
So a few. So I recently finished the Last Lion series, which is a series of biographies of Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. And they're quite thick. But they are beautifully written, incredibly engaging. You'll like blast through 1,000 pages at a time in no time. And to give you a kind of an understanding of both kind of the end of empire and the early 20th century, just through the prism of this kind of remarkable man, was fabulous. So from a biography perspective, I highly recommend those. And actually, one of the books recently that kind of blew my mind a little bit was Siddhartha Mukherjee's Gene: An Intimate History, which starts off with some of the kind of classic things that you might have read about before, about kind of Mendel and Darwin and the rise of kind of understanding about chromosomes and the double helix, and then kind of builds from that and gives you kind of an understanding of kind of what's happening now. And quite frankly, we are we're in one of the most interesting periods in time now. With so there's this thing called CRISPR, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with.
No.
So there's if you'll permit a little bit of time on this.
Sure, absolutely.
So there's kind of four pieces of the puzzle here. So with Genentech, we started being able to do recombinant DNA, which is being able to take virus DNA and insert it into human chromosomes. So it was like taking foreign DNA and putting it into our own DNA and adapting our own DNA, and using that to potentially solve for diseases and so forth. But it was something of a shotgun effect. We didn't really know where it was going to attach on the chromosome. We didn't know what other things it was going to affect. And so forth. And also, it was a problem that even if you were able to use it to fix something like sickle cell disease, which is a big problem, particularly in the kind of West Indies, which is a genetic hereditary disease, you could maybe fix it for that one person, but it would still be hereditary for their children.
Right.
Then kind of two things happened. One, we started being able to get embryonic stem cells, which were cells that could become sperm or ova and adapt the genes within them, the DNA within them, although it gets still with this kind of shotgun effect. And then recently, this process called CRISPR, it was the first process, there's a couple of others now that do this, which allows us to kind of laser target exactly where on the chromosome we wish to change and make one like singular change. So I want to change something from GTCA to GTCC in the genetic codons, one particular place in the chromosome.
Wow.
And if you start to put the pieces together, what that means is this, is that we can take an embryonic stem cell, we can use recombinant DNA and CRISPR to target a particular piece of our genome and change it. And then using IVF, you can actually create, you can make it so this hereditary disease, like sickle cell, disappears. And this is both incredible and scary.
Yes.
So from an incredible perspective, think about no more children being born with blindness or deafness or hereditary diseases in the future, which is one incredible perspective. The other perspective of this, of course, is, we're starting to understand genes for intelligence and for height or for longevity. And that starts to get very, very interesting when you start to think about
engineering the perfect children or something like that.
Yeah, and especially if it's expensive, because then suddenly you start to have rich people who are able to have taller, smarter, more long-lived children, and you start to really have kind of challenges to the... this notion of equality in humanity. So there's actually kind of something of a moratorium on some of this work right now, but it is utterly fascinating to think about. And so that is one of the things that's been really kind of capturing my imagination.
Yes. It's mind blowing.
It really is.
Yeah. It gets into the world of science fiction
It's a thing that we may be one of the last generations of humans who are kind of naturally who kind of arrive in some way still through natural selection, and this could change. There's people talk about transhumanism and so forth.
Yes.
And to people it sounds like crackpot theories, but when you look at the state of where biological science is right now, it's awesomely close.
It is, and wasn't there a there was an article that came out this week that says that I guess uploading our consciousness into computers is now possible. I can't remember the exact article, but it's
I haven't read that piece, yeah. Although I can only imagine that for my own consciousness, you wouldn't need very much RAM for it.
Yeah, well, it's but you know, this whole we're opening up some really interesting frontiers, and we talk about risk and, you know, exploration and all of that good stuff. It's I think we do need more people with your, you know, with your mindset than less, to be perfectly honest, because if we're starting to open up new ways of thinking and things that require or that aren't going to be solved with templates and current ways of doing things, then we need people that have more of an exploration and risk-based mindset, to be honest.
I hope so.
Look, I really, really enjoyed this, Tony. It was a great conversation. I want to be mindful and respectful of your time. Was there anything before we wrap it up? Was there anything that you wanted to add that we didn't get a chance to cover?
No, I think this has been pretty comprehensive. I just wanted to thank you. This has been great fun. It's been good fun to chat.
No, it's been a pleasure. For people that are listening that want to maybe know more about you and follow you on social media and things like that, what might be some of the best places to do that?
Well, if you're a fan of bad puns and anti-Trump ranting, then I'm on Twitter as as Arctic Tony. Uh-huh. If you like very occasional blog posts, you can find me at tonyhale.com, and it's pretty easy to work out my email from that as well.
Perfect. I'll put it all in the show notes. I'll also everything that the main things that we talked about and these book recommendations, etc. I'll put those in the show notes as well. This was great. I really appreciate you coming on. So thank you. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to following your next venture or ventures.
Thanks,
yeah, thank
it was,
you.
It was my pleasure.
I hope you guys found that to be both enjoyable and useful. All the links to the things that we talked about, including how to find Tony, his website, how to find him on social media, etc., they're all in the show notes, so do check those out. Check out allthingsrisk.co.uk, as I mentioned, our new website. And I'd love to hear some feedback. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. I want to know what you like, what you don't like about the show, recommendations for future guests, all that kind of stuff. Once again, the new schedule. So in 2 weeks' time, there will be another full episode. So that's September the 20th. And there may be an episode next week, but you're going to have to stay tuned to find out or simply subscribe. And speaking of which, if you give us a rating or a review on iTunes, particularly if you subscribe there, that really helps us out. So once again, if you can do that, that would be great. Or simply share the show. That would also be very, very helpful. Chances are, if you like the show, many others would as well. That's all we have this week, but stay tuned because there's some great stuff on the way. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.